Boy, that was a double dose, wasn't it? Okay, if you came tonight expecting the singing, then I apologize to you. Pardon? Oh, okay. Yeah, it was. So if you came expecting singing, then you didn't read the bulletin, right? How about turn it down just a little bit, if you would? We got an echo here. And hang on to the slide just a few more minutes, and I'll get that up in a minute. Tonight is the first lesson in our summer series that will go through August. And each Wednesday evening of June, July, and August, we'll have guest speakers from other area churches. And our theme this year is going to be, what do we learn from Jesus' encounter with, and then you fill in the blank. And other than tonight, we'll continue our singing format on the first Wednesday nights, and the reason that got changed was because of me. We're going to be gone next week, and Cleo had wanted me to kick it off, so this time last year, I was in the hospital with a heart attack, I guess I was probably getting out of the hospital about now, but my family and I had leased a house in Destin, Florida, and the heart attack happened within 2 weeks of our having Leanne's wedding, as you all know. Well, I'd already completely paid for this house for 21 people on the beach so that our family could all be there, and it was within the time when there was no refund. But so I didn't even contact the guy about it, but he contacted us and said, I know the reason that you canceled, and so I want your family to pick another week. And so I thought that, well, he'll be talking about in the off season. He said, no, I want you to pick a week when you can all be here. So we chose that week at that time. So let the record show that we had our week planned before VBS dates were announced. All right. So I didn't intentionally mess that up, but I'm glad that you're here tonight. Let me give you a quick rundown of who the speakers will be. Next Wednesday night will be our congregational singing. And then the following June the 20th, Alan Hahn with the paralytic, Jesus' encounter with the paralytic and his friends. And then June the 27th, Dale Foster, the centurion. And then July the 4th, we'll have a congregational singing. Kevin Hahn will be July the 11th, the sinful woman who anointed Jesus. Our own David Sparks, by the way, whose dad passed away this past week, will be in speaking on the woman caught in adultery and those who brought her. And then Carson Stevens will have it the next week on July the 25th. It's what you say that counts. Then one more congregational singing, and then Randall Tucker from South Union in Houston will have Pilot. John Helbig Longmire will have Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Frank Farr from EEM will have the rich young ruler, and then Kevin Montgomery will have Peter. So that'll be our format for this summer coming up, and I'm looking forward to hearing at least some of those along with you. Our lesson tonight is, what do we learn from Jesus' encounter with a Samaritan woman? And you're likely familiar with the story that we call the Good Samaritan. Well, tonight our lesson is going to be on the Bad Samaritan. This is a woman who had a poor reputation. And I want to give you some background and setting, and I told Cleo that I had entirely too much time to prepare for this lesson because I have enough material that I could teach for the whole next quarter on this woman, Samaritan woman in John 4. But I did want to give you some background, and one of the reasons is, this is kind of preparatory, and at least in my preparation, I'm going to give you a brief summary of some of the history behind this encounter that Jesus had with this Samaritan woman, because Lord willing, it's going to be brief tonight, because I'm planning to teach a series that I consider to be extremely important and beneficial this fall, and this scripture and this incident will be what I'll use as a launching board and keep coming back to this incident and Jesus' conversation with this woman. But I do want to give you some historical background, and I'll give more at that time. In that series, I plan to focus on the doctrinal and the practical implications of what Jesus said to that woman about worship. I think we've been entirely too shallow in our interpretation of what Jesus said to her about the time is coming and now is when true worshipers will worship him in spirit and in truth. And so we're going to have some lessons on that. But in this lesson, I want to focus on the personal interaction between Jesus and the woman and some implications for us today, some lessons. And so I want you to be thinking about it as we go read through this lesson. And you be thinking about what you think the implications for us. What can we learn from this encounter? I want to set, first of all, this story in John's Gospel. This is in John chapter 4. I would encourage you to turn there. This is the only gospel account of this incident. John's the only one who records it. And do you remember, let's put it into John's purpose for his gospel. Anybody remember what John, he stated what his purpose for his gospel was in John 20, 30, and 31. You remember what he said, why he wrote this? Say it loud enough they can hear. That's right. Believing you might have life through his name. So he said the reason, he said Jesus did many things that are not written in this book, and we could say, or in any other book. But he said these are written, these have been chosen so that you might believe that Jesus is a Christ, the Son of God, and believing you might have life through his name. That's why he wrote the gospel account. That's why the particular incidences were chosen and put into the order in which they were. And the details about them, the peculiar details about each one of them, that's why those details were recorded. So that you can come to faith in Jesus, to give you evidence that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So, that being his stated purpose, can you tell me anything in this incident that you know about that would indicate that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Now, if that were a question on a test, you remember the Samaritan woman, we'll read it in a few moments, but the Samaritan woman and the encounter with Jesus and their conversation, was there anything in this that you could pull out and say, this is evidence that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Okay. Okay. That would be the thing that I'd pull out. Tyrone said that he knew the intimate details of her life in the past. So now that within itself doesn't prove that he's a Messiah. It does prove that he's at least a prophet, doesn't it? But it is an evidence. You don't necessarily have any one evidence that proves everything. But it is one brick in the building to give evidence that Jesus Christ is, in fact, who he claims to be. And so his knowledge of her background would be one of the reasons, primary reasons, why John would have set this in here. Because he shows this woman who was not associated directly with the Jews, in fact, she was an outcast, that upon meeting him, she drew that conclusion. And so this is an incident that shows that the people that Jesus encountered had enough information provided to them that they could draw this conclusion. And she'll come to the point where she'll say, okay, sir, I perceive you're a prophet. And then she will come to the end and she will say, could he be the Messiah? This could be the Messiah. And so the evidence is there. Secondly, that's putting it a little bit in John's, the context of John, the purpose for his gospel. Let's put it a little bit in the cultural and historical setting, and we could spend a lot of time here. First of all, what is Samaria? Where is Samaria? What is Samaria? Okay. Where did it get its name? Or where did they, or it? We hadn't said what it is yet. Exactly. Samaria is a town, and Samaria is a region. Sometimes that confuses us if you don't know that. Samaria is a town. It was the capital city of the 10 northern tribes, Israel, right? And it will later come to be known, the region around it will come to be known as Samaria. And the Bible will use the terminology in both ways. It says this woman was a Samaritan. It doesn't mean that she came from the city of Samaria, but she came from the region of Samaria. When the Assyrians, and let's go back and pick up a little bit, you know and you've heard all, probably most of your life, that there was a great amount of hostility between the Jews and the Samaritans. And let's talk about a little bit why. When the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom in 722 B.C., they deported many of them, meaning that they picked them up, took them to another place. In fact, the annals of Sargon II, we still have those, by the way, record the deportation of 27,290 slaves from Samaria. Well, that's a pretty good bunch of folks, but it left more than that in the region. So they didn't take all of those northern tribes of Israel that would have primarily been, what, two tribes? You remember right in the heart of Israel? Ephraim and Manasseh. And so the Samaritans really claim their heritage from Joseph, his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And whenever this group of people that got left, the Babylonians will come back later. And by the way, whenever you leave a house in a vineyard vacant, what's likely to happen? Somebody's going to come in and start living there, aren't they? I mean, we've seen some of that in some of our, you've read some stories about that whenever people walked away from mortgages here recently, haven't you? Sometimes they left some really nice houses empty, and next thing you know, somebody's in that house, and they're living in the house. Well, that's exactly what happened. Whenever you have a place that's vacant, then there's going to likely be somebody that's going to come in and take up residence there. And if they can, they're going to try to claim this for themselves, and that's exactly what happened here. And then to add to that, when the Babylonians will come and take the southern tribes away, which will be 135 years later after the Assyrians have taken Israel away, then they will also have the deportation policy. They'll take people away, but they will be more organized in bringing other people in. And they will bring people in from five different countries to settle in that region. And so you think about now, if you've taken everybody that God gave them that land, and so they all had the same heritage, had the same religion, spoke the same language, all of a sudden, a vast number of them are gone. Other people come in and inhabit the places where they left. They don't have the same gods. They don't speak the same language. They don't have the same culture. They don't have the same values. And so you're going to have people pulling in pretty tightly, right? If you can imagine something like that happening here today, and, you know, every, let's say every third house or two out of three houses, the government took people away and sent them all over the world, different places, and they brought people from China, and they brought people from Africa, and they brought people from Eastern Europe and all over the world and settled them in here. And so on this side of your house, you had some folks who spoke Swahili, and the only one that could understand them would be Judy, Cleo's wife. She could understand them, but none of the rest of us probably could speak Swahili. And then on this side, you'd have somebody speaking French, and there might be a few folks who could understand that, but most of us couldn't, because Americans are notorious for being monolingual, speaking one language. But imagine what that does to the community. So your kids grow up, you know, you're scared of these folks. You know, they've got weird ideas. They got a weird God. They do weird things. You know, everything about them is weird, and they feel the same way about you. And so you tell your kids, don't go over there and don't be messing. Don't be playing with those kids, you know. And next thing you know, though, they slipped over there and they're playing together a little bit. And next thing you know, one of them's marrying one of them, and everybody throws a fit about it and so forth, and time passes, and then things, you start speaking one another's language and so forth. And that's kind of what happened here. Bring the slide up, and you have the history of where that happened in 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 5. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land. He marched against Samaria and laid siege to it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala and Gozan in the Harbor River and the towns of the Medes. The king of Assyria, dropping down to verse 24 now, the king of Assyria brought people from, and you can read them for yourself, 5 different countries, all right, to replace the Israelites in the town, into the towns of Samaria. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. When they lived there, they did not worship the Lord. So he sent lions among them, and they killed some of the people. It was reported to the king of Assyria, "The people you deported and resettled in the towns of Samaria do not know what the God of that country requires. He sent lions among them, but you're killing them off because the people do not know what he requires." Then the king of Assyria gave this order: "Have one of the priests you took captive from Samaria to go back and live there and teach the people what the God of the land requires." So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord. Nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in several towns where they had settled, and set them up in the shrines of the people of Samaria had made at the high places. The men from Babylon made Succoth-Benoth. The men from Cutha made Nergal. These are the names of their gods, by the way. Men from Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire as sacrifices to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Seraphim. They worshiped the Lord, but they also appointed all sorts of their own people to officiate for them as priests in the shrines of the high places. They worshiped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the custom of the nations from which they had been brought. To this day, they persist in their former practices. They neither worship the Lord nor adhere to the decrees and ordinances, the laws and commands that the Lord gave the descendants of Jacob, whom he named Israel." So that's the biblical synopsis of how the Samaritans began. Question: how are the Jews in Jerusalem going to feel about the Samaritans? They're not going to like them, are they? And that's putting it mildly. And there's going to be religious problems with them. Now there's going to be social problems with them. There's going to grow up an intense dislike for one another. And over a period of time, you're going to see some things that happen. It's almost like what's happening between Republicans and Democrats in our society. Some really stupid things happen sometimes. Really childish things happen sometimes. Well, when the Judean exiles, and let's run ahead here now, the Judean exiles returned from Babylonian captivity. Now, I've run ahead about 205 years because when the Babylonians carry Judah away captive, that will be 135 years after Assyria has carried Samaritans away and the northern tribes away. And then 70 years of Babylonian captivity, that comes to a little over 200 years. Then they have had 200 years of living in Samaria. And they've kind of developed their own mindset, their own religion. It's kind of filtered down. And the story that's told in Ezra and Nehemiah, whenever they return from the captivity, is that the Jews that come back from captivity have maintained their purity. They still can trace their ancestry back. Well, the Samaritans can't do that anymore. And so when the Jews come back under the Medes and the Persians to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city walls and rebuild the city, restore the law, then these Samaritans, these northern tribe folks come and they're, you know, here, they're going to welcome their relatives back, and they come and say, we want to help you build the temple, and what do the Jews say? Not going to happen. You're not going to help us. We don't want your help. We don't want you around here. And so now, these rejected Samaritans did everything that they could within their power now to start discouraging and try to stop the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. They sent letters to Artaxerxes, the king who had given them permission to come back and had even actually funded it. They did everything they could to stop it. And so hostilities developed, and they really intensified. How would you feel if you were a Samaritan and you came and offered your assistance to help build this mess of a rubble, the city and the temple back, and they said, no, we don't want you. You're a half-breed, and you're not going to have anything to do with this temple and anything to do with rebuild. How would you feel? Well, you can get a little inkling of how they felt. There had always been tension between Judah and Israel, even during the period that we call the United Kingdom. In our Thursday class, that's one of the things that we've observed. Even during that period of time, when they were all united under one king, there were still 2 southern tribes and 10 northern tribes, and they still fussed among one another. But now these hostilities have intensified. If you would, give me the next slide. Now let's get a little bit of a geographical, and that may not be big enough for you to see right there, but where the little red balloon is, that's going to be the city of Sychar, where this woman is going to come from. The Samaritans are going, since they're not going to be allowed to have anything to do with the temple at Jerusalem, they're going to build their own temple. And when we go into our series this fall, Lord willing, we'll talk more about how that developed. But they built a temple on Mount Gerizim. And this city of Sychar is going to lay between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Does anybody remember anything biblically about Gerizim and Ebal? That's right. Whenever they came into the land to conquer the land, then God had told them, when you get in there, I want you to go to the valley between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and I want you to set up the blessings on one side and the cursings on the other. And Mount Gerizim had the blessings, Mount Ebal had the cursings. And it was going to be, what do you call it, when one person speaks and then somebody responds. Responsive reading? You know, whatever, I don't know. But they divided them up in half. And one half would pronounce the blessing, and then in response, the other ones would pronounce, if you don't do that, then God is going to bring this curse. They would pronounce the cursing, and it went back and forth and back and forth. So they were called the mounts of blessing and cursing. And Gerizim was the mount of blessing. And so they chose, I suspect maybe because of that reason, who would want to build a temple on the mount of cursing, you know, but the mount of blessing. So they built a temple there. And it was a rival temple to the one in Jerusalem, and they had a number of priests, Levitical priests, who defected to the Samaritans because they had morally compromised their own lives, and they didn't want to change, and the Samaritans accepted them as their priests. So you had a temple on Mount Gerizim the Samaritans had. You had a temple in Jerusalem. Both of them had Levitical priests. Now, the Samaritans are also going to complicate the matter a little bit more because they trace their ancestry back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the way down to a point. And so they're going to accept the Pentateuch, first 5 books of the Old Testament. But everywhere where the promises were made about Zion or Jerusalem, they're going to go through and white out that, and they're going to put Gerizim. And so it came to be known as the Samaritan Pentateuch. Well, obviously, the first people who did that knew what they had done. And maybe their children knew. Now, I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, but nevertheless, basically, this is what happened. By the time you got down to their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, then all they knew was that this was their Bible. And when they read their Bible, all of the blessings and all the prophecies about Jerusalem in their Bible that said Gerizim, Mount Gerizim. And so they had a problem. I mean, they both had evidence. They could whip their Bible out and show you, you know, why they did what they did. And so this got to be more and more animosity between the two groups as time went on. Let me give you a few quotes. No, forget it. I've got too much here. Josephus, some of this is really, you know, it shows some of the silliness that people go to, but let me just relate a couple of them rather than reading it to you. In 9 A.D., Jesus would have been alive. It was the custom of the priests in Jerusalem on the Passover to open the city gates at midnight. Well, there weren't a lot of folks out at midnight. And the Samaritans knew that that was the custom, and so they were hiding, and when the city gates were opened, they ran in and scattered human bones all around the temple and the temple area just out of rivalry. It's kind of like football teams, you know, in neighboring towns. You have this rivalry. And so just out of meanness, well, how did that make them feel? That desecrated the temple when they did that with these dead human bones. So those kind of things created even more animosity. Another one that I thought was kind of funny was, and Elton has talked to us about how they announced the beginning of each month. It was with a new moon. And somebody had to come to the rabbis and say, there had to be reliable witnesses who would come every month and they would say, I have seen the new moon. And that started the new month. Well, that was really important because their religious festivals all were dependent on it being the right date. And see, they're on a lunar calendar rather than a solar calendar like we are, and so it's going to be different. And different months are going to have different numbers of days and that kind of thing. And so whenever it was accepted that somebody had seen a new moon, then there was up on a high place outside the city of Jerusalem, there was a bonfire, a huge bonfire ready to be lit. They would light it, and then that would show, people would be able to see it for miles around. Well, they had, in every direction, they would have others who were positioned also to light the bonfire. When they saw that fire in Jerusalem, they would light their fire. It would go out in other directions, and it would go all the way through the land of the Jews and even into areas around the land of the Jews, announcing the first day of the new month. And it was really important, and that's the way they did it. Well, the Samaritans got a kick out of lighting a bonfire before it was time to light it. And then all the ones who saw it started lighting the fires, and it would just go out that way. So in Jerusalem, the rabbis had to stop using that method of announcing the new month, and they had to start sending messengers out, you know, individually to places. So that's the kind of thing that happens when rivalries get going. Let me give you, and I don't have this on the slide, but let me give you four stages that this woman, and I knew that I had too much material here, my class is nearly over, four stages of this woman and her knowledge of Jesus, and you can follow this yourself as you study it. Verse 7 through 10, she drew the conclusion, he is a Jew. Verse 11 through 15, she drew the conclusion, he's greater than Jacob. And then verse 16 through 24, she drew the conclusion, he's a prophet. And then 25 through 30, that he's the Christ, or the Messiah, or the anointed one. So let's quickly read through at least part of chapter 4. The Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John. And then John will write in here, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now, this will mark the transition between what is known as the Judean ministry and the Galilean ministry. Now, feed that back to me. Why did Jesus leave Judea and go to Galilee? And what we just read. Somebody tell me why. Let me read it again. The Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it wasn't Jesus who baptized but his disciples. When the Lord learned this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. When he learned what? When he learned that the Pharisees were taking note of the fact of how many disciples he was gaining. Now, why would that cause him to leave? Because he knew that they were going to try to do something about it. And it wasn't time yet, right? But they didn't like John and all the disciples that he gained. In fact, John's disciples didn't like the fact that Jesus was gaining so many disciples. If you'll go in chapter 3, verse 26, John's disciples came to him and they said, "Hey, you remember that guy that was on the other side of the Jordan that you put the finger on and said that he was the Christ? Well, he's teaching and gaining, everybody's coming to him." And then John will talk about the bride and the groom and the best man, and that one increases and decreases and so forth. And so in response to that information, then John preached a lesson to his disciples. But now in response to that information that Jesus got about, now the Pharisees are talking about how many disciples, how many people are coming after me, it's time for me to leave. And so he left Judea, which would be in the south, and he went north. Now, if you were a good Jew, you had a circuitous path you were going to take to go from Judah to Galilee. You were probably going to cross the Jordan River and hit the King's Highway and take I-25, north. And you were going to, and that would go all the way up, and then it would cross back over into, it's not on this map here, but it would cross back over just south of the Sea of Galilee into the region of Galilee. And by the way, it was a paved highway. It had pitch. They had bitumen. Is that the way you pronounce the word? Pitch, tar pits around the Dead Sea. And they took that and paved that road. And so paved roads weren't brand new to the United States of America. But it was a really good highway. That's the way that you would normally go. But the main reason you would go there would be why? You wouldn't have to go through Samaria. The Jews so detested by this time the Samaritans that they would, when they came, if they had to touch Samaritan soil, when they got to the border, then they would take their clothes off and shake the dust back across the line so they wouldn't bring any of that filthy Samaritan dust with them when they came. They'd take their shoes off and hit them together to get that filthy Samaritan dust over there and not bring it back with them, and they'd take a bath before they went in their own house, because they considered the Samaritans to be worse than dogs, and they considered to eat with a Samaritan and to eat what a Samaritan ate to be worse than eating swine's meat. They had an intense hatred. So, verse 4 says, now Jesus had to go through Samaria. And we could talk about why he had to go there. I think he had to go there because he had an appointment. He was the only one who knew about that appointment, but he knew what was going to happen. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given his son Joseph, and Joseph's spring was there. By the way, your Bible may not say spring, but the two times it uses right here, the word is spring. And that's kind of important. I know I'm not going to have time to tell you much about why, but it's important that it is a spring. It's like an artesian well. It's a place where the water bubbles up out of the ground. So Jacob's spring was there. And by the way, they had made a well out of it. And Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. Now, I don't know what time it was. If you're using Jewish time, it was one time. If you're using Roman time, which John was wont to do, then it was probably 6 p.m. And sometime if you want to see how you figure that out, Roman time, it could have been 6 a.m. or 6 p.m. But if you look at the setting here, they're going to encourage Jesus to come into the town and to stay with them. And so I think it was probably late in the day, probably 6 p.m. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food, so he was there alone. You got the picture of Jesus being there with the woman by herself. Have you ever been in a situation where it felt a little awkward? And I was trying to think of how to say this. You ever been in a setting where you stepped on an elevator and it was just you, if you were a woman, and there was another man, and he wasn't particularly, you were kind of afraid of him. Maybe he was not very desirable. And there was something about him that just really made you ill at ease. Or if you were a man and you stepped on and there was a woman there that just made you really ill at ease. Well, you intensify that many times over of what this woman felt. Now, by the way, Jesus didn't feel it, but the woman felt it. Here she comes up to the well to draw water, and as she approaches it, she sees from the distance a guy sitting there. And if it's a single woman and a man, you know something about the taboos between men and women even talking in this society. You didn't talk to a woman that was, in fact, you still don't today. You don't dare talk to a woman that's not your wife in public. And so as this woman approaches the well to draw water, there's a guy sitting there, and as she gets closer, it becomes obvious that he's the foreigner, and as she looks, he's a Jew. And so as she gets closer, this is going to be really, really awkward. And there's an awkward silence, but Jesus broke the silence, and he said, "Will you give me a drink?" Well, what's unusual about that? Well, first of all, that she was a woman. Secondly, that she was a Samaritan. And the idea that a Jew would drink from any kind of a vessel that a Samaritan had was just preposterous. It was crazy. Nobody would ever conceive of that ever happening, because a Jew was too good to drink out of anything that a Samaritan had touched, and a Samaritan woman on top of that. And so, and then John tells you that he was there by himself. By the way, here's a little insight, I think, into if you want to make a friend of somebody, you're the new kid on the block, and you want to make a friend of somebody, you just move to a place, and you meet somebody, and you're trying to make a friend. Two ways you can do that. There's probably a lot more ways than that, but two ways in regard to this. One is you can do a favor for that person, a little something. You know, you take them some food, and you introduce yourself, and you've done a favor for them. That kind of ingratiates you to that person, right? But there's another one that's even more subtle. You can ask them for a favor. You don't ask them for a big favor, but you ask them for a little favor, something that they can do pretty easily. And there is something psychological about you being asked to do someone a favor that puts you in a favorable position with that person. Now, I don't know. I think probably if you think through that, you've found yourself in that situation before. It's a pretty good way to start a friendship. Ask somebody, you know, I see you've got, you know, lots of tomatoes here, whatever. You know, I love tomatoes. Would you give me a tomato? And, you know, they got them rotting out on the vine out here. So, yeah, they'd be glad to give you a tomato. Now, if they only got two or three, you don't ask them for a tomato, you know. But, you know, if they got lots, okay? And so this woman had a whole pot full of water, so it wasn't going to be a big deal for her to give him, you know, a little drink of water. And so just a little quick insight into making friends. And Jesus knew certainly all that. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" And then John puts his parenthetical, "Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And the word is really not associate. The word literally says the Jews do not, literally, use, U-S-E, together with Samaritans. The implication is a Jew, the Jews do not touch any kind of a vessel. They don't use anything that a Samaritan has used. And so what she's saying is, are you asking me to drink out of my pot? Because Jews don't have anything to do with what Samaritans have touched. They don't use it together. They wouldn't. You could have the most beautiful vase in the world, and if a Jew found out that it was came from Samaria, it didn't matter how cheap it was. He wouldn't touch it. He wouldn't have anything to do with it. So they don't use. She said, "You don't use these things together." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks for drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." And now we're getting down to where I should have been about 35 minutes ago. And then she says, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, and as did his sons and his flocks and his herds?" And Jesus answered her, "Whoever drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up into eternal life." And so now she asks, she goes back to what he said, "If you knew who I was and if you knew what God had to offer, you would ask me and I would give you water." And so now she comes to the point where she asks him, she said, "Sir, would you give me that water?" Now, there's a lot of, it's almost a riddle what he said. If you go back, interestingly, to chapter 3, Jesus had just had a meeting with a Jewish man who was extremely scholarly in chapter 3. And Nicodemus, you remember? And he was a member of the Sanhedrin. Highly educated, Jew, male. The gospel applied to him. Here, within a matter of hours, he's sitting at a well. Here's a woman who's not a Jew, she's a Samaritan. And she is not moral at all. Nicodemus was highly moral. This woman is immoral. Her value system is radically different. Now, I'm not going to have time to tell you what I should have in all this lesson, but one of the things that I draw from this is, and I would ask the question, do you think that Jesus could save this woman? Now, you better think your theology through before you say that. And if we had time, we'd talk about what she's going to have to do to be saved, because she's shacked up with the guy. She's had five husbands, and the guy she's living with is not her husband. And Jesus is talking to her about this living water, and if you would ask me, and so she asked him, "Now, do you think that it's possible that she could be saved?" I find that a pretty deep question right there. And one of the things that I think we need to draw from this, by the way, do you think that when and if this woman was, do you think that she felt worthy to be saved? You think she ever felt worthy? Do you have to feel worthy to be saved? No, in fact, if you do feel worthy, you're probably not. That's exactly right. And I think that has some really deep implications right there. I have people regularly who come to me and talk about, "I just don't feel worthy." You're not. And neither am I. And you don't have to be. That's the good news. If you were worthy, you wouldn't need a Savior, would you? And I think this woman probably, very likely, if she did respond, and we're not told a lot about her response, we're told something about her response, but we're not told a lot about what she personally did. But if she did, I would suspect that she might struggle with that, maybe much of her life. That might be a real problem in her thinking about her past and how she didn't deserve this. And she didn't. But then neither did Nicodemus, did he? And he would be a lot more likely to think maybe he did. Or someone in his position would be much more likely to think that they did deserve to be saved. But neither one did. And so the gospel is equally applicable to this man who was highly moral and this woman who was very immoral. It was equally applicable. It takes the same thing to save each one of them. And so let me just end it by saying I'm sorry I didn't get any further than I did, but I knew I wouldn't. And don't judge a book by its cover. Don't make up somebody's mind for them of whether or not they'll respond to the gospel. You let them have the opportunity to accept it or reject it. It's not, we have a tendency to survey the situation and say, no use in presenting the gospel here. They wouldn't be interested. Their life is just too messed up. Really. Jesus didn't seem to feel that way about it, did he? Okay, thank you.